everyone, and welcome back to Murder, Mother and Me, where each week we will dive into some of the most infamous murders, mysteries and everything in between.
So if, like us, you are intrigued by all things true crime, you're in the right place.
I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your other host, Patty. I'm the mother.
And I'm the me.
As always, thank you for all the support so far on the podcast and to all our listeners near and far.
Please follow, share with your friends, and write us a review, and as Patty would say, only if it's a good one. All right, Mum, are you ready for this week's case?
Yeah, it's a bit of a heavy one this week, so that's why I need this slice of Victoria sandwich cake and a cup of coffee before I start.
First of all, who calls it Victoria sandwich cake?
Isn't that what it's called?
It's called Victoria sponge cake.
Oh, why is it called a sandwich then?
And we've got some lovely coffees from Rose Lane Coffee today, which is in Allerton.
Shout out to Rose Lane Coffee there.
Right, should we get on with the podcast?
I think we best had. This week, we are talking about a story that takes place in 1986. Here are a few interesting facts about that year.
The Prime Minister of the UK was Margaret Thatcher. Not sure we like her. The biggest music sensation of that year was Madonna. And the most popular baby names were Jessica and Michael.
That's funny that you know, because when I was in school a long, long time ago, my favourite two names ever had a baby, which I didn't even want to have a baby, to be honest, really. I don't know how that happened, really.
Thanks, Mum.
Was Jessica and Michael. But then I changed Michael to Ross before Friends was even on. And everyone was saying, that's not a name. It's like a surname. But I thought it was great. It sounded American. I liked it.
Before we get started, just a quick disclaimer. Obviously, this is a true crime show, and we discuss serious crimes, sometimes involving violence and sensitive topics. We do aim to balance respectful storytelling with light-hearted commentary and a bit of humour to keep things engaging, but rest assured, the humour is never at the expense of the victims or their families. So if you're here for bad jokes, interesting stories, and mine and my mum's very silly sense of humour, then please stick around. Viewer discretion, and maybe a sense of humour, is advised.
Right, everyone, let's get on with this week's episode. This particular case sent shockwaves around the world, and for some reason, it's stayed on my mind for all of these years. It's one of the most horrific cases I've ever heard, and this is the tragic story of the abduction and murder of Anita Cobby. On a warm February evening in 1986, 26-year-old nurse Anita Cobby was walking home after a quiet dinner with friends. She never made it. What followed was one of the most brutal and heart-wrenching crimes Australia has ever seen. Five men driven by cruelty, abducted, tortured and murdered an innocent woman, uniting the entire nation in horror and grief. But before we go any further, let's go right back to the beginning. Anita Lorraine Cobby was born on November the 2nd, 1959, and grew up in Sydney, Australia. She was beautiful, intelligent, and full of life. At 26 years old, Anita had already accomplished a great deal. She was a former beauty queen, winning the Miss Western Suburbs pageant at just 20 years old. But Anita wasn't just about looks. She had a passion for caring for others, which led her to pursue a career in nursing. Anita had recently graduated from nursing school and worked at Sydney Hospital. Those who knew her described her as gentle and kind, a person who always had a smile on her face. At the time of her murder, Anita was living separately from her husband, John Cobby. They had married young, and while they were still in contact and very much cared for each other, they were going through a trial separation. Despite their differences, there was no doubt that John deeply loved Anita.
Just off the cuff here, do you know if he was ever a suspect?
He was initially the prime suspect, yes. And I believe he was questioned extensively by the police and actually admitted to doing it at one point.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was interrogated so much by the police, so extensively, that I think he just broke down and said he did it in the end just to make it all stop. But he definitely did not do it. We know that now. But I think that was just, he just couldn't take anymore, basically.
There's quite a lot of cases out there like that, though, isn't there, where the police have forced a confession out of people?
I don't know whether they forced it out of him. I think they actually believed that he probably had done it at that point.
But, I mean, they hammered them down so much that in the end, the person just wants to get out of the room.
Yeah, the questioning, I think, was relentless. And according to John, from an interview that I heard with him, they threw him up against the wall and different things like that, although they denied doing that. But when you see the kind of police that were involved, they were very good, you didn't get me wrong, but I think they were big sort of, you know, Australian cops, and I think that was the way they handled an interrogation situation. On February the 2nd, 1986, Anita finished her shift at Sydney Hospital after a long day of caring for patients. After going for dinner with work colleagues, all she wanted to do was go home and relax. She caught a train from Central Station heading towards Blacktown, the suburb where she lived with her parents. It was an ordinary night, but little did she know, five men, John Travers, Michael Murdoch, and brothers Michael, Leslie, and Gary Murphy, were about to cross her path in the most horrific way imaginable. Anita got off the train at Blacktown Station around 9 p.m. From there, she still had about a 20-minute walk to reach her parents' home. That's when everything changed. As she walked alone, the five men, driving a stolen car, spotted her. They were cruising the streets that night looking for trouble, and they found it in Anita.
So, by the sounds of that then, she wasn't an intended victim as such?
I think they were just going around looking for anyone. It would have been probably the first woman they spotted or the first one they thought they were able to abduct.
Yeah, and if it wasn't Anita, it would probably be someone else.
It could have been anyone, I think. Anita was grabbed violently off the street, thrown into the back seat of the stolen car and driven to a remote, isolated field in Prospect, an outer suburb of Sydney. What followed is unspeakable. These five men, acting with unimaginable cruelty, dragged Anita into the field and subjected her to hours of violence, torture and sexual assault. As the men brutalised her, Anita, in a desperate attempt to save herself, reportedly told them that she was a nurse and that she was married. She begged them to stop, hoping that appealing to their humanity might spare her life. But there was no humanity left in these men. After their vicious attack, John Travers, the ringleader, took out a knife and slit Anita's throat.
I was just going to say, even just from that first couple of sentences, there was no humanity to be appealed to, was there, from the get-go?
No, these criminals, because that's what they were, they had a past as well. And at this point in time, there was nothing they wouldn't do. A couple of them were, if you can even say this, were worse than some of the others. There was definitely a ringleader, and that was John Travers. Although he wasn't the eldest of the perpetrators, he was possibly the worst one. And he was the one willing to go that extra mile to make sure that Anita could never testify against them. This is just a sort of basic overview of what actually happened. You know, they dragged her into a field and assaulted her and then murdered her. But the actual details of it are so horrific. The autopsy report was actually blocked from the public for a long time. They dragged her through a barbed wire fence for a start off. And then the gang raped her one by one in every way imaginable. And then to finish it off, he jumped on her back and pulled her hair back and slit her throat. And she put her hands up to her throat and it nearly severed her fingers. And when the police found Anita in the field, which was a while later, they'll never forget the look of horror on Anita's face. And she was identified, I believe, by a wedding ring. They took it to her family and it was covered in blood.
I was going to say, it said hours of torture and abuse, which is not just a spur of the moment thing, is it?
No, this was literally hours of Anita not knowing if, you know, she was begging for her life and trying to appeal to them by saying she looked after people and she was a married woman. They weren't going to let it go, but she didn't know that. And so can you imagine how long that must have been? 5 minutes must have been awful. Half an hour must have been awful. They actually, when they put Anita in the car, one of them sat on her in the back seat and they drove to a petrol station, took her money out of her purse, which was what she'd just been working for, you know, helping people all night, and that was the money that she's earned. And they used her money to buy things in the petrol station and petrol and to drive her out to the death scene, basically. And that ride alone was a good while to get to the outer suburbs. So she was actually assaulted in the back of the car as well. They beat her as well, and she had a broken nose and all different things. So she not only did she endure that, there was then that prolonged attack in the field after that as well.
Yeah, it sounds like they were just out to hurt people.
They just literally didn't care. There was no empathy at all within any of them. And you know, what I take from this, I think this is why this case has stuck with me for so long, is anyone who has got any kind of like relative of that age or anyone they know, a friend or whatever, I've got a daughter who's that age, roughly. Anissa was 26, my daughter's 28. You've got a wife who's a similar age. You know, how can you not put yourself in that position of imagining if something like that happened to them?
Well, also, I think she's just, like you said, she's been working all day. She's just trying to get home. And I can't even imagine how she must have felt when that car pulled up next to her and she's seen five men sat in there, because that's already intimidating. Even if they were just wolf whistling or whatever out of the window at her, that would be intimidating enough, never mind one of them jumping out and grabbing you.
An interesting fact about it actually is that when she got off the train, her dad, who normally picked her up, he'd said, when you get off the train, give me a call. And in those days, there was no mobile phones. I don't think they were commonly used anyway. And this phone at the station was broke, so she couldn't ring her dad. So she decided to walk home, because obviously these are the streets she'd grown up on, and she felt at ease, really. And then never in a million years would she have expected this to happen.
So she actually never would usually walk home on her own from the station. Her dad would pick her up.
No, I think, you know, her parents were very loving parents. They were very dignified parents. Her parents' names were Gary and Grace, and they were sort of old school parents, absolutely lovely people. I just don't know how they ever coped with this. She had a sister as well, and they were just a lovely family, you know. Another thing is, when Anissa was actually abducted off the sidewalk, the house from where she was snatched, she was walking past at the time, there was two young people alone in the house. I think they were about 16, 17, and they saw all this happen. And the car had driven off, and the next door neighbour had come home, and the man next door jumped in a car with his friend, and they chased the car. They tried to find it, but it turned off somewhere and they couldn't find it. And, you know, they did try to intervene.
I just think, what are the chances that the one night that she can't get in contact with her dad to pick her up from the station, she decides to walk home, is the one night that these five lowlives are driving around in a car?
Yeah, just really sad, really unfortunate. But, you know, was that a matter of fate? I mean, the way this all lined up was kind of strange, really. Anissa's body was discovered 2 days later, on February the 4th, 1986, by a local farmer. It was clear from the scene that she had endured horrific abuse before her death. The police launched an immediate investigation, but they faced a challenge. Anissa had no known enemies. Why would anyone want to hurt such a kind and gentle person? Detectives began combing through evidence, speaking with Anissa's family, friends, and anyone who might have seen something that night. It wasn't long before a witness came forward, a man who had seen a group of men near Blacktown Station around the time Anissa disappeared. This lead would be crucial in the investigation, as it would eventually help police identify the five men responsible for Anissa's death. The investigation picked up speed when police arrested John Travers on a separate charge. During his questioning, an informant came forward, someone who knew Travers and his gang. This informant revealed that John Travers had bragged about the crime, providing explicit details that only the killer would know. With this confession in hand, the police arrested Travers, Michael Murdoch, and the Murphy brothers. Under pressure, they eventually confessed to their involvement in Anissa's murder.
So that is kind of like what you were just saying. Everything seemed to line up, even in the way that they were captured as well.
Well, it was this witness that had seen them. Obviously, they'd been cruising around that night looking for other women. And Anissa was unfortunately the person that they, you know, settles on in the end.
Do you know what I never understand? Why do criminals find it so necessary to go around bragging about what they've done? Like, I know they are actually stupid, but are they actually that stupid?
Well, they're a different kind of person than us, aren't they? We don't think like that, do we? So who knows why they do that, you know? I'm sure not all of them do that, or they'd all be caught, wouldn't they? So there's plenty of them on the loose. So they don't all do that. I think it depends on the kind of criminal they are. These were actually not very intelligent, because their IQs were tested. Their defence was that they'd had a hard life and been subjected to all kinds of, you know, absent fathers, beatings by the father, you know, that kind of thing. So now let's look in more detail at the five men who committed this atrocious crime. We'll start with suspected ringleader John Travers. John Raymond Travers, aged 18 in 1986, was raised in relative poverty in Blacktown, the oldest of eight children from unmarried teenage parents. By age 14, he was already an alcoholic, and was expelled from high school during year 10 for being continually disruptive to other students. Beyond schooling, Travers held few jobs and relied mostly on unemployment benefits as a source of income. He was eventually committed to Boys Town, a juvenile detention facility. Sorry, Boys Town sounds like a pop group. Oh, I'm sorry, I just spoiled that. Boys Town? Isn't this like the Village People? Let's do that bit again. He was eventually committed by his mother to Boys Town, a juvenile detention facility. His father, with whom he never shared a close relationship, left the household in 1981. Finding it difficult to support the family, Travers relied on crime to provide food, such as stealing animals for the family's dinners, including chickens and ducks from nearby households.
Oh, here we go. The age old, let's start killing animals before we kill people.
Well, I actually saw an interview with John Travers where he tried to portray himself basically as a Robin Hood type character. So he was...
What, steal from the rich, give to the poor?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he said. He said, you know, we don't... When he was housebreaking and things, because, you know, he lived a life of petty crime before this big crime, we only break into rich households and things, so they can afford to lose it. You know, never mind that he traumatised people along the way, but that was the whole reason why he said he did it.
But this is trademark psychotic killer behaviour, isn't it?
Yeah.
They start with animals and then they start working their way up eventually to humans.
Making an excuse, really, for... Because I'm sure there's a lot of people that can't afford food and different things, but they don't do what he did. The health of Travers' mother eventually deteriorated and he and his siblings were sent to live with foster families while she was placed in a hospice. Travers had a history of violent sexual behaviour against males and females, as well as bestiality.
But I can never wrap my head around bestiality.
I'd have sent him down for that alone. He would never be walking the streets again. Witnesses have also recounted that, on several occasions, Travers had acquired a live lamb or sheep for butchering prior to a barbecue party, alleging that he slit the animal's throats as he sodomised and abused them sexually, before butchering and roasting the carcass on a spit.
He just sounds like an absolutely awful human being.
He's not a human being, is he? That is pure evil. Moving on to one of the other suspects, Michael Murdoch. Michael Murdoch, aged 18 in 1986, was a childhood friend and criminal associate of Travers. He had also spent a great part of his childhood in juvenile prisons, where he experienced sexual assault. He was known to have written to politicians during this period of imprisonment, seeking protection from such assaults.
So it sounds like they all had some kind of history with either committing sexual assaults or having been sexually assaulted themselves.
Sounds to me that this Murdoch fella was more a victim of Travers, really. He's a childhood friend of him. I'm guessing these sexual assaults were probably done by John Travers.
Yeah, it sounds like he was just following the leader kind of thing.
That's what I was just going to say. It sounds like he was influenced by him. The fact that he's writing to people to try and get help doesn't excuse him. I don't mean that. But it kind of tells me that he was, you know, he was a follower, exactly like what you've just said. Now, finally, on to the Murphy brothers. Michael, Gary and Les Murphy, three brothers from a family of nine children, were also accused of the crime. Nine children?
How can anyone even push nine children out?
Good Lord. I mean, this is unusual in itself, isn't it, to have three brothers involved in a crime all in at one time? I'm pretty sure these have all got individual records, but, you know, they've all come together for this one crime with a couple of others as well. Michael Murphy, aged 33, was the eldest of the nine Murphy children. He was sent to live with his grandmother when he was 12 years of age. His younger brother, Gary Murphy, aged 28, had a hearing impairment that affected his schooling, and he left early to seek work. He was noted as being an able and willing worker before the crimes. Gary's strong interest in cars led to him facing several car theft-related charges in the years preceding the murder. Les Murphy, the youngest, aged 22, was known as having the worst temperament. He had faced children's court on many occasions for a number of theft-related offences before being accused of the Cobby murder.
So everyone involved in this murder had a history of either petty crime or, you know, a lot more serious crimes?
It seems, though, doesn't it, that these brothers, there was nothing really serious. I mean, I know all the crimes are serious, but not as serious as, obviously, the murder.
Yeah, it was more petty crime.
You know, to escalate it to that level, there had to be some other kind of factor involved. And to me, that factor was John Travers. The one thing I've noticed, though, from all of these suspects that they were at the time, is their upbringing. So there was kind of, there was no stable family structure for them. And that does not excuse it in any way, but it does explain somewhat why they turned out the way they did. Although I'm sure there's many people all over the world that, you know, don't have privileged upbringings and even come from broken homes, and they don't turn out like that, so...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think that is... I'm sure it plays a part in the decision-making of all of these men. However, I don't think it's a valid reason to kill someone.
So this then brings up the question, is it something in somebody? Is that in everybody and it takes something to bring it out, so it's actually in everybody? Or can some people just resist that, you know, or don't have that in them? I mean, was that just like an accident waiting to happen, basically, and it just took the right person to come along to trigger it all?
Well, I think even just going back to our first episode that we did about Brian Blackwell, he had a really good upbringing. He had a really loving family. They would have done anything for him. He was an only child. They gave him everything he wanted, everything he needed. And one day that switch flipped. So I think it's not necessarily about the way you're brought up. I think it is something that maybe is inside all of us.
I think the way they were brought up was a contributing factor. But I actually think probably the others would have gone on committing petty crimes, but maybe nothing so serious. I just think John Travers, for me, was a different level.
Yeah, I think some people are obviously a lot more evil than others. And I think for a lot of people, it might just, this thing that we're talking about, this switch inside, it probably just lays dormant throughout your whole life. But I think with people like John Travers, it's very much at the forefront of what he does.
I think he probably has a lot of anger issues as well. You know, he was a violent person. You can just tell that just from the reports. But, you know, there must have been a lot of anger there, I think. And again, that's no excuse, but I think that plays a huge part in it.
So are we saying you think that the way people are brought up, you know, is a factor in whether they will commit a crime or not?
I think it's a contributing factor, but I think you can put any number of people in a given situation and they'll all react differently. I think everyone's got a breaking point, or maybe it's just a level of evil inside somebody. Because I'm sure everyone's got a bit of everything inside them, but I think there was a lot more evil inside John Travers. The trial of Anita Cobby's killers began in 1987, and it was one of the most widely followed cases in Australian history. The courtroom was packed with spectators, journalists, and Anita's devastated family. The details of the crime were so horrific that some jurors reportedly wept during the proceedings.
Didn't you mention that someone had leaked the post-mortem results or something because they wanted everyone to know how bad it actually was?
Yeah, I think at the time the police were withholding the details of what had actually happened to Anita, and there was a radio host called John Laws, and he managed to obtain an illicit copy of the post-mortem results, and he read them out live on air, and it outraged the entire nation, and it stirred up a lot of, you know, trouble, really, to the extent that people were making nooses and hanging them outside windows. And when these men went to trial, it was just surrounded by people. I mean, they basically wanted to tear them apart. Because I think the thing about this whole case is Anita represented every woman. She was every woman. She was a normal, young, working class girl going out, just doing her job, actually was helping people. So that kind of made it worse, you know, the kind of profession she was in, because where would we be without nurses and doctors and things? And she was just making her way home after a long shift, just like probably millions of other women do. And then just to be taken the way she was.
I think it also causes more uproar when it's a random attack as well. Because it could have been anyone.
Well, that's why people identify with it. They've all got somebody, you know, of that age, I think. And of course, you project that image, don't you, onto the, you know, the victim becomes somebody you know, and then it brings it closer to home, I suppose.
What I mean is there was no relation between any of the five perpetrators and her whatsoever. It was completely random.
Yeah, it could have been any woman. And she did nothing at all to provoke the attack, or, you know, it was just a chance encounter. Their paths crossed, and that was the result of it. All five men were charged with murder, rape and abduction. The prosecution presented a damning case using the men's own confessions and forensic evidence to show the cold, calculated nature of the crime. Each of the accused tried to minimise their role in Anita's murder, blaming each other or claiming they were merely bystanders. But there was no escaping the truth. Their brutality had left indelible marks, not just on Anita's body, but on her family, her community and Australia itself.
Again, that's just typical of criminals, isn't it? When it's more than one criminal involved in a case, it's always, well, he did it, not me.
Well, it's every man for himself then. They're all brave on the night, aren't they, or the time it happened. And then suddenly they're all trying to, pass the book, basically.
Yeah, and cut themselves a deal by saying, oh, well, I actually wasn't as involved as he said I was, but he did more than I did, and so on.
Another thing about this is, as well, the way they actually got John Travers to confess was a relative of his came forward, and she actually did go out of her way of own personal risk as well, because there could have been a lot of repercussions for her, and she went into prison and they wired her up. She took a young child with her as well. She warned the child, don't mention like the wires that mummy's got on. And she did put herself right, at the forefront in danger, because they knew people outside, even though they were at that time in custody, they did know people outside. And she asked him, and she managed to get a confession out of him. Without that confession, I don't think they could have pinned it. The final blow, Anita, killing Anita was done by John Travers. And when he slit her throat, he actually nearly decapitated her as well. And she actually got that out of him. And he was quite proud of the fact, actually. There was no remorse at all.
Okay, so if a family member of his came forward and actually helped the police, get a confession out of him, surely that would have put her in further danger as well.
They actually put her in the witness protection program afterwards, so to this day, no one knows what name she goes under or where she lives or anything. During the trial, considering it was such a serious subject and, we all know what happened, the accused didn't even show any kind of remorse or did not even give Anita's family any kind of empathy or dignity. I mean, the family themselves sat there. They were like the total opposite, really. They were like a bunch of, I don't even want to say animals because I don't think of animals like that, but they laughed during the trial. They just weren't not one bit bothered at all.
I think that's so awful for a family to sit in court as well and see the murderers of your daughter just laughing and joking about like it's not a really serious crime.
It was so disrespectful and obviously made it worse.
And it also doesn't give the family any closure whatsoever. It's also quite confusing that they would start acting up in court like that as well, considering it says when they were arrested that one of them weed his pants.
Weed his pants. Wet himself.
But you know what I mean? It seemed like some of them were quite terrified when they got arrested and when they got caught.
Well, on the night the crime happened, they were all together, weren't they? They were like pack animals, really. So, they were all big, brave men then. But when they were all on a one-to-one situation with these big, massive big cops from Australia, they weren't so brave, were they? And I think when they arrested them, one of the arresting officers just had no messing and put his foot on his... I'm not sure which one it was, but put his foot on his head. This was brought up at trial, I think. His defence lawyer was saying, how did he get these marks on him? And he said when he arrested him, he stood on his head. And I think everyone applauded, because they wanted to see Anita get justice.
Do you think it's the reason they were acting up in court is because they just thought, well, we're going down for this anyway, it's quite obvious. There's no way they were ever getting away with it.
No, I don't think it was that. I think they just didn't care. I just think the implications, I don't think any of them, it didn't matter to them.
Well, I suppose when you've lived a life of crime as well, it's just, for them, it's just another notch on their criminal record, isn't it?
Yeah, probably was a badge of honour, to be honest. It just did not seem to affect them. Maybe long term, I don't know, but at that time, they didn't care. It was like she was disposable. I think that was the worst thing about it. She was just nothing to them. And for her family to sit there and witness them behaving like that, it was adding insult to injury. Within a short time, the jury returned its verdict, guilty. All five men were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. For Anita's family, it was a small comfort. Justice had been served, but nothing could ever bring their beloved Anita back.
I don't think there was any other option but to give them life without parole, was there really?
I don't think somebody like that can ever be rehabilitated. So, it would only take for them to meet the wrong person again and get into that kind of lifestyle again. And I wouldn't want them to come out. It brings up the question of the death penalty, doesn't it? Which I know is a very controversial subject, but do you agree with it or don't you agree with it?
What is your stance on it?
I used to always say no many years ago. But I just think where there's incontrovertible evidence, as in this case, I don't see the need for them to be here, to be honest. What are they contributing to society?
Yeah, I think my view is, if there's irrefutable evidence that 100%, without any reasonable doubt, that you committed the crime, you shouldn't have the privilege of still being able to be here.
Well, it's a choice, isn't it? No one has to do that, so you make that choice, therefore stand by your choice. I just know if that was one of my family members or loved ones or whatever, I know what I would want to happen. I wouldn't want them to be on the same earth. And whether people agree with that or not, it's a very personal opinion, isn't it, you know? But I know, put yourself in Grace and Gary's shoes.
Well, it's also, yeah, they've been found guilty and they've gone to prison and they will never see, you know, normal life again. But in my opinion, is it not still a bit of a privilege that they just get to still live life after committing such an atrocious crime?
It doesn't just end there, though, does it? It's the people it affects afterwards. Her parents, Grace and Gary, have got a life sentence. Her husband, because she was still married to John Cobby at the time, went on to get married again, but could never. He ended up getting divorced. He had a son. He took drugs and drink and everything, just as a way of. He said he actually just hoped he overdosed and just didn't get up one day because he just couldn't live with the fact that he couldn't protect her as well. And he really did love her. Whether they were going through difficulties and whether they were separated at the time and whether they would have actually got back together is a different issue. But from his point of view, he was filled with rage. And who can blame him, really? To watch these five men in the dock knowing what they did and he wasn't there to stop them from doing it. He lives with that guilt every day.
I mean, who knows if he could have stopped them if it was still... There's still five of them and one of him, but I think it will eat him alive thinking that he could have done potentially something at least.
Anita Cobby's murder wasn't just a personal tragedy for her family. It had a profound effect on Australia as a whole. People were horrified not just by the brutality of the crime, but by the randomness of it. This wasn't a targeted attack. Anita was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. The outcry led to a renewed focus on victim support services, and her story inspired many to call for stronger penalties for violent crimes, which is what we just said.
Yeah, it's what I said earlier about... It literally could have been anyone. It wasn't that they were specifically targeting her. If any woman would have walked past them, they would have seen it. I think they would have done the same thing. And to me, that's terrifying.
In the years following Anita's death, her parents, Gary and Grace Lynch, became tireless advocates for victims of crime. They worked closely with organisations that supported the families of murder victims and established a foundation in Anita's name to help survivors of violence. In doing so, they helped to ensure that their daughter's legacy would be one of hope, resilience and care for others. Just as Anita would have wanted, I would imagine.
I think the main thing for me in cases like this, and it is in a couple of other cases that we've covered so far, is that these families, even though they've been through something so tragic and so horrendous, they still find the strength to try and help other people that might be in similar situations, you know, by starting foundations and charities and other things like that. I think that's so admirable and so incredible that they can do that, having been through such a horrible time in their lives.
Yeah, I think they just want to prevent any other family having to experience what they have gone through themselves. And actually, Anita's mum was a nurse as well, so that caring thing runs through that right through the family, I think. The murder of Anita Cobby is a case that has left a scar on Australia's collective memory. It was a crime of unimaginable cruelty, but it also serves as a reminder of the preciousness of life, the need for vigilance, and the importance of justice. Anita was a woman who dedicated her life to helping others, and her story continues to inspire people to fight for a safer, more compassionate world.
Bloody hell, Mum, that was quite a heavy case, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it? But, you know, it was a case that really had an impact on me when I first read about it and heard about it.
Okay, everyone, hope you're feeling okay after that one. That's it for this week on Murder, Mother and Me.
Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.
And remember, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.